Hello, this is Terrence McNally. This weekend, when folks and communities around the world took part in a global day of climate action, I want to play for you my October 2017 conversation with Paul Hawken about his project and best-selling book, Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, which ranks the 80 most impactful solutions.
An entrepreneur of both the business and the social variety, a challenging and inspiring speaker, and a best-selling author, whose latest book is Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. But first, after hosting and producing the show for nearly two decades, in 2014, I stopped recording new live interviews, and the show continued on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, streaming relevant interviews from the archives. Podcasts available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, and that's terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same site. But with the election of Donald Trump, I can't resist exploring our path forward in new interviews. So first, I'm going to offer you a few websites for information on how to participate in resistance to Trump and the movement toward the healthy and just future we need. And you can email me at temcnally@mac.com to get these websites and more. Indivisible Guide, one word, indivisibleguide.com, probably the biggest national organization with thousands of local chapters. OurRevolution1word.com that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, long a leader in online activism, now coordinating much more closely with on-the-ground grassroots work. Five Calls, that's the number five and the word calls, fivecalls.org, which tells you the upcoming phone calls to your representatives that are relevant. TownHallProject1word.com tells you when representatives might be holding town halls in your area. And finally, CourageCampaign1word.org, and that's primarily in the state of California, but a wonderful and very, very active organization. I first interviewed today's guest, Paul Hawken, in 2007, so 10 years ago, on his book Natural Capitalism, which he co-authored with Amory Lovins, though we'd met over his earlier book, The Economy of Commerce, which is really a groundbreaking work that brought together environmental thinking with economic thinking in a way that hadn't really been done before. I've interviewed him a number of times since. Our paths consistently cross, and we've even worked together on a project for a while. Weeks back, when we initially booked this interview, I sent Paul an email, as I do, generally setting up what we might cover. I wrote, and I'm going to read, this is what I wrote, "I imagine we'll talk about Drawdown, the new book, probably a status report on where we stand regarding climate, what you expect between now and 2020, Trump's first term, a global perspective, and finally what listeners should be paying attention to and what they can do. Then I asked any other perspectives or frames you'd like to talk about." And here's Paul's response. So you're reading my emails over my shoulder here, guys. "Where we stand, re-climate? Too broad, methinks. We being? What I expect? In what terms? Weather? No idea. I can only repeat climate science mantras about intensification. Trump? Dead horse. Too much focus on corruption and dysfunction. We know this. Beating it on and over changes nothing. Drawdown is about solving things. We have a near constitutional crisis, but we are only one of 194 countries, and we tend to globalize our idiocy. I want to talk about the climate narrative, how we got the narrative so twisted, how we continue to use fear and polemics, threat and guilt, and how that will never work to change or motivate. How the climate establishment has mangled science communication to the point that most people have turned off. Finally," he says, "I want to have an original conversation that does not go down the same old rat holes." And in my reply, I thanked him for both the offer and the challenge, and that's going to be our aim for the next hour, not to go down the same old rat holes. Drawdown maps, measures, models, and describes the 100 most substantive solutions to global warming. And for each solution, Drawdown supplies its history, the carbon impact it provides, the relative cost and savings, the path to adoption, and finally, how it works. Drawdown is about changing the narrative, not based on spin, but on the existing solutions that can, in fact, reverse global warming. As Paul says, the science is impeccable, even historic, but our communication is failing. And we humans, this is me talking, have got to get this right. As a species, we've survived and flourished because we're social, because we plan, because we collaborate. But too often today, I believe those impulses fail to rise above tribalism. Us versus them. And I've been struck this year by a quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, best known for The Little Prince. Here it is. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Through Drawdown, though Drawdown does go into some detail about how we'd best gather wood, it also hopes to offer a compelling narrative, one that can move Americans to yearn for a future richer than the past so many seem to want to go back to, a vision that engages our emotions, one that fuels our yearning rather than feeds our fear. Climate change is an existential threat. But here's my favorite dictionary definition of courage: the willingness to confront and deal with those things recognized as difficult, dangerous, or painful, rather than withdraw from them. Drawdown grows out of that kind of courage and begins to supply the narrative that can make that sort of courage more likely. Mark Hertzgaard, friend of the show, author, environmental correspondent of The Nation, says you should all buy this book and, quote, read it like your life depends on it, because it does. Paul Hawken has founded several companies, starting in the 60s with Aeron Trading, one of the first natural food companies in the U.S., Smith & Hawken, a retail and catalog company, One Sun, an energy company focused on ultra-low-cost solar. As an author, his other books include Growing a Business, The Ecology of Commerce, Blessed Unrest, Natural Capitalism. Welcome again, Paul Hawken, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Hey, Terrence, how are you? That's great. I'm going to hire you to do my introductions everywhere I go.
Glad to do it. Glad to do it. So in that intro, I described you as both a social and business entrepreneur, leading organizations as well as companies, an author, a speaker. I mean, a lot of different things over the years. How do you see your work? Have you been restless? What's the thread that you see as you look back now? What's your narrative?
Change and learning. I've gone into business because it's the most effective way to implement something socially, not because it was a business. And I go into, you know, nonprofit world because it's the most effective way to do something. So to me, it's really about the vehicle. Is it a Jeep or a truck or a passenger car? I mean, is it a business? Is it a nonprofit? It doesn't make any difference to me because the purpose and the focus is on change, on achieving something. And that was certainly the case with Project Drawdown.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I've noticed in interviews that I've looked at for this one, and perhaps you've always done this and I just hadn't noticed before, but you seem very willing, guy throws you a question, woman throws you a question, to say, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, some cases implying, how could anyone know?
Yeah.
And I see you trying to be very precise about what your lane of expertise is and how to stay in it. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. When you get talks or when you write books, you get what I call Wizard of Oz questions, you know, which are like, how will we solve, you know, how can we create world peace, you know?
Right. How do we turn it all around?
Yeah, as if anybody knew and as if it was even possible. So I think on this one, especially the question you get is, what should I do question in so many forms, you know, but basically give me a call to action. And what I'll say is, I have no idea what you should do. I don't know you. You've just raised your hand. I would love to know you, but I don't. And therefore, if I give you an answer to this, you should run, because it's not true. It's just a projection. And I feel like there is a kind of sense that has come out of climate, which is probably derived from political activism, which is, you know, here, do this, do this, do this. And those are very important things to do. You just rattled off a list of a whole bunch of things that, you know, websites that people can go to that really inform them about things that they can do. And that's a fantastic list, by the way. And but with respect to climate or global warming, you know, the tendency has been to blame others or to try to change Washington and change politicians. They should change. If we had a functioning government, we would accelerate everything we're doing. You see that in Germany and Denmark and Scandinavia, you see very functional governments, and their approach to climate change and global warming and clean energy is far more advanced than ours. So there's no question that a good government would accelerate those, but the fact is the solutions do not come from government, and they never have. Not in an Obama administration, not in a Clinton administration, not in a Bush administration, and not in a Trump administration. So the solutions come from the middle out, not from the top down, even the bottom up. And so I feel like the emphasis on the idea that somehow if we get that right, we'll solve the problem is absolutely incorrect. If we get that right in Washington, it will accelerate what we are capable of doing, but it is not the source of solutions.
Mm-hmm. That, in fact, having your eye on that ball is, in some sense, taking your eyes off the real one.
Yeah, I mean, exactly right, because, in a sense, I talk about it in my talks too. You know, you can look at climate change or global warming as happening to you or for you. It's prepositional change. To means you're the object, you're the victim, short end of the stick. You know, people did it, they shouldn't have. I mean, and then you blame them, you sue them, you demonize them. Point fingers at them, whatever. And do you really want to live your life that way? So the other way is to look at climate change as happening for us, which is basically it's a system, atmosphere. It's feedback from a system. Any time the feedback from a system is not responded to, the system dies or fails. We know that. It's not that the Earth is going to fail, but the human system will fail if it doesn't respond to feedback. So feedback is a blessing. It's a gift. It's an offering. When we get a fever, we get, a symptom, that's feedback from our system, our human body. And so this is feedback. We should be welcoming it. We should say, whew, wow, good, thank you. The science, as you said, quoting me, is impeccable. It's the best problem statement that I think a group of scientists have ever created for the world, which is the IPCC science, okay? So every time we see a headline about, two Cat 5 hurricanes hitting the same island, within 30 days, it's like, wow, what a validation of that problem statement. I'm not trying to put aside in any way the suffering of those people or the implicit racism in the way we've dealt with it. That's another subject. But I'm just saying in terms of the phenomena of two Cat 5 hurricanes, we can say, wow, that scientific statement or problem statement is so validated. It's being validated every day. If it keeps being validated, what we don't want to do is keep, in a sense, immersing ourselves in the problem statement, in the problem statement, in the problem statement, which is actually a fear statement. It's a threat statement. It's a gloom statement. It's like we're screwing up statement, And what happens is it just doesn't motivate people. It motivates a few people, but not very many. And then you say, well, you should do this. You should drive a different car, and you should do this and ride a bike, and you should eat, more vegetarian, this and that. And you say that to most people whose lives are pretty complex and stressed already, and they just turn off. They feel guilt, and they feel shame, and they feel like fear, and you mix those together, and you get numbness, you get passivity, you get, I can't handle this, my mom has Alzheimer's, the kids are having trouble at school, the mortgage. I mean, that's what most people are dealing with. So if we're going to create a movement around reversing global warming, it has to be a very, very different quality of communication than the one we have right now, which is basically polarizing.
I really see that combination that you talked about. You start with, you lay out fear and doom. You mix that with your own shame or guilt. I'm not doing enough. I should be a better person, but I don't have time. And as you say, that is not what moves people. That is what shuts them down. And I'm thinking in our own lives, if we're in a relationship where we feel that we're not measuring up, if we don't get bigger very often, we usually get smaller.
It doesn't work with our partners, so how
does
it work
with
the world?
Exactly. And our children,
I mean, that's not how to raise children. It's not how to be a, quote-unquote, a manager or a supervisor or a boss. That doesn't work.
Yeah.
And yet we think that that's going to work for society as a whole.
So you and I have been actually probably talking about climate change, among other things, going on 20 years.
Yeah.
How and why, when you look at that, did the climate change narrative get so mangled? What is it in us writ large or in us in that movement, you know what I mean, that let it go that way?
Well, one way, it's a good way to raise money. And if you want to raise money, hit people's adrenal glands and show a confused, crazed polar bear on an ice floe looking, panicking, you know, and that's true, and that's horrible. Don't get me wrong. Just like the panda bear, remember? And for WWF,
yep.
And, you know, use charismatic species or use calving glaciers or hurricane vortices or, you know, use show suffering, you know.
Flooding of cities now.
Yeah. And then people go, oh, I'll write a check. I mean, I want to do something. And then $25 and I'll give it to, you know, this group. And so it's worked as a way to raise money. And so I think the NGOs are addicted to it.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do. And but what for me 20 years ago, I mean, this book goes back to 2001, not quite
right.
20 years ago. But and at that time, the third assessment came out. And at the same time, the Carbon Mitigation Project of Princeton came out later that year with the famous global wedges, you know, the eight wedges that if we did them all would stabilize emissions by 2050. And I looked at that like everybody thinking, okay, wow, we have, you know, scholars here saying, look, we have a way to get out of this, you know, at least to stabilize emissions. And I looked at it and I was just stunned because of the initiatives that comprise that you could choose from to create those eight wedges. I mean, 11 of them could only be done by large, virtually multinational corporations. And they're all underwater financially. And that means the boards of directors of conservative energy and utility companies and car companies would have to vote to spend down their balance sheet to create these solutions, which are too expensive, and that the Carbon Mitigation Project depended on that, including things like making hydrogen from coal with carbon capture systems, which still do not work to this day, and that was 2001, this is 2017. And that's when I started thinking about drawdown, which is not so much to criticize Princeton and the Carbon Mitigation Project, but I was saying, whoa, what can we do? Where do we stand? I want to know where we stand, you know? And do we have the means at hand to address this? Not, you know, pie in the sky, hydrogen capture systems from coal mines with CCS, but I mean really on the ground things, what would it cost? And if they scaled over 30 years, could we achieve drawdown? And the other part of that, Terrence, is like this thing of stabilization, mitigation, reduce, you know, it's like what an underwhelming goal.
Yeah.
You know, here we are we're seeing already, you know, at 1C, you know, the kind of extreme weather we saw this fall, and we're still going, and there's no stability at 450 ppm, at 500 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. And so I feel like we haven't even named the goal. And so I wanted to name the goal, which can we just reverse this? Not, I mean, as a goal, can we just name the goal? I don't know if we could do it at that time, but I knew that we could name it. And if you don't name the goal, you'll hardly achieve it. And sometimes when you expand the scope of a goal, it actually makes it easier because there's more innovation, more space for creativity and genius, invention, et cetera, as opposed to a narrow goal, which is we're going down the wrong road, we're going to go over a cliff, and everybody slow down. Well, you're just going down the wrong road more slowly, a little bit more slowly, and you're still going to go over the cliff. And that essentially has been the mantra, the communication, inadvertent as it may be, from the IPCC, from COP 19, 20, 21, 22. I mean, it's really been the same communication, which is the word mitigation. I don't even think people know what mitigation means. I think they think it means stopping. But mitigation means lessening the pain,
the impact,
or seriousness
yeah.
of something.
Yeah.
What kind of goal is that? If you're like, you know, being hit, you know, or somebody's violating, you say, well, we want to mitigate that. We want to, you know, don't hit him so hard, you know.
Don't hit me so often. Yeah,
not so often, just once a day, not twice a day, you know. I mean, so what a strange goal for us to have when we know that the only way we can, in a sense, go forward as a civilization is with relatively stable climate, which we've had for 10,000 years in the Holocene period. And so I wanted to name the goal. And that happened in 2001. And I went around to large NGOs and spelled it out. So this is where I think we need to know and do the research on the 100 most substantive solutions to global warming. And people are very receptive, very nice, and said, God, sounds great, good idea. We don't know how to do that. That's not our expertise. And everybody I went to said the same thing. And they said, why don't you do it? And I said, well, because I don't have that expertise either.
Right.
And so it just lay there sort of for years, you know, and I hadn't forgotten it. But during that time, I kept watching the communication part become more and more polarizing, at least in this country. And frankly, ineffective.
Yeah, well, I mean, so much of what you said as you're saying it combines in my head. I mean, one is that, as you say, if you want to really mobilize people, you don't say, you know, let's go for a tie, right? You don't see the stands jumping up and say, tie them. You go for a win.
Right.
And so if communication is to affect change, it has to motivate. And so I really get that. And so it's odd, actually, you know, how it happened that we all centered on unmotivating goals. But once you set that goal, what you said was no one felt they could do it. My guess is partly because no one had even been thinking that way, right? So when they say I don't have the expertise, it's just, wait a minute, I'm down this path, I'm applying for grants, I'm doing what I'm doing. That's a nice idea, go do it. So it's sitting on your back burner, kind of nagging at you, but not really taking off. What spurred you a couple of things must have happened to spur you to take it on. One, you had to get that spur harder, and two, you had to feel you could do it.
Yeah, two things happened. One is that Bill McKibben wrote a piece in Rolling Stone 4 years ago called Global Warming's Terrifying New Math.
Right.
And that article was based on Mark Campanelli's work at Carbon Tracker in London, where he basically showed that the coal, gas, and oil assets in those fossil fuel companies were unburnable. In other words, that if we did burn them, it would be Venus. In other words, they are not assets. And as Mark said, Bill made poetry out of that data
right. In
his article. That article was really true to its name. It terrified people.
Mm-hmm.
And because essentially what Bill did was burn it and say, look what happened. Kind of like Mark Linus's book, 6 Degrees, or David Welsh Wells' piece in the New York Magazine a few months ago.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I mean, that he did the same thing. He did the Mark Linus thing, but he burned it and said, now, what do you think?
Yeah.
You go, ah. But Bill did it really well, and I had people come to me who said, it's game over.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to move to British Columbia, get a small farm, take my kids, you know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
It's like, I'm checking out on this one. I worked hard, and we failed. And I thought that was fascinating, and that sometimes when we give up, that is surrender, that actually it's game on. It's actually not game over at all. It's like it's an opening. And I feel that we just saw that in a small way, well, maybe not so small, but because of Hurricane Irma and Marie, Rhea, that the majority of Americans now say that warming actually is the cause of the intensification of storms. Okay, that's a huge breakthrough in polling for Americans who didn't make or wouldn't make that association.
And let me just jump in and say what I think that means. One of the problems with taking on climate change, getting active on climate change, getting serious about climate change, was it seemed too big, too distant, too complex. Once the public begins to see the connection with something which is happening right now and which is enormous, that changes, that mm-hmm. lines things up differently. Good.
Yeah, it really does. And so I just felt like it was game on and that we still had never done what I suggested in 2001, which is the map, measure, model.
And what changed that made you feel you could take it on?
I felt we're at the point, more of a teachable moment for all of us, and for myself as included, because I certainly, and we became a we very, very quickly, certainly didn't know the answers to those questions. We didn't know whether drawdown was achievable. We didn't know what those solutions were. We didn't know what impact they would have, and we modeled the money. We didn't know what they would cost and whether it would be a loss or profit. We knew nothing. And any bias or ideas that we had about what it would turn out to be were wrong, which is good in a sense because none of our biases, or virtually none of them, were confirmed in the research we did over 3 years.
And by none of them, I don't think you mean you were wrong about everything, but you were wrong about what actions
the ranking,
have the most
the
impact.
Yeah. But I mean, look. If you listen, what are people saying? You know, basically, what are the solutions? Solar, wind, solar, Elon Musk, and don't eat so many burgers. I mean, really, 90% of the, you know, is over and over and over again. And that's just a scientific hollow. That's not true. And all of them are crucial. I mean, solutions, don't get me wrong. I mean, absolutely crucial, but they are not sufficient unto the day.
So let me emphasize a little bit what you just said, that in most of the conversations, for as long as we've been talking about it, the focus is almost always on energy. The focus is almost always on fossil fuels versus renewables. And and again, we said it before, if you put your eye on that one, your eye isn't on what you really want it to be on.
Yep. And everything else. It blots out the sky. And, I mean, the reasoning is very straightforward, which is, you know, 60 to 70% of the CO2 up there is from excess CO2 from since the industrial period is from the combustion of fossil fuels. So it makes sense to say, well, that's the most important thing to do. But actually, even if we were to do that yesterday, you know, 100% clean energy in the world, we would still have global warming. So there's many other causes, and you would not get drawdown. You would not get reversal.
Right. And so when you start looking for reversal, you start looking for a drawdown, it widens your view, right?
It does. It does, because it goes to the earth. And to the old paradigm basically is, you know, we burn too many fossil fuels, you know. I mean, that's the paradigm, and we've got to reverse that. The real paradigm is we interrupted every cycle on earth. The water cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the carbon cycle, every cycle of a functional Earth has been interrupted by human activity, and so what we have to do is restore that. And one of them is the oceans and the land. And so we looked at photosynthesis, aka land use, you know, in a very serious way. And because all the data that we chose on carbon had to be from peer-reviewed literature. We couldn't do what the IPCC has done until recently, which is talk about ag and forest. Well, there's no such thing as ag. There's no such thing as forest. It's just a general term, you know. But what forest? Upper montane, you know, dry land? I mean, you know, it's like, which forest, where? And the same thing with ag. Ag, what ag are you talking about? Organic? You're talking about biodynamic? You're talking about regenerative? You're talking about managed grazing? You're talking about silver pasture? You're talking about, I mean, it goes on and on and on. And so because we were science-based and are science-based, we had to go to the science. And so we came up with basically 23 different land use solutions that have a significant impact on reversing global warming, because they do two things. They don't emit carbon or nitrous oxide.
So they don't add to the atmosphere.
They don't add, and they actually bring back CO2.
Mm-hmm. And
sequester. They
you know,
down.
One thing, you're still looking, and these solutions still look at what we do. They still look at our behavior. But I think that shift you just talked about is really crucial, that I think there's a grandiosity and a narcissism about humanity that we said we caused the problem, and we looked at the biggest one, which was fuels, fossil fuels. And
right.
So we have to look at that thing that we did, and that's where we'll do our repair. And what you said is when you look at the natural rather than we, rather than humans, the natural, you begin to look at natural processes, and now all these other things unfold themselves in front of you.
Exactly. And it's really getting in alignment. Somebody said to me once in a Q&A, well, that's a very ambitious goal, you know, draw down reversal instead of reduce, reversal, very ambitious. And I said, you really, we draw down 6 to 7 parts per million every year naturally on an annual basis. In the fall, the leaves die and the plants go, and it gets cold in the northern hemisphere. We burn, you know, coal and gas, you know, and oil. And emissions go up, both from the land and from anthropogenic combustion of fossil fuels. But in the spring, even though it warms up, we don't use as much to heat our homes. You know, the trees, you know, leave out. You know, the grasses come up. Farmers plant their fields and so forth. And actually, you have a reversal. Actually, CO2 levels go down on the Earth. So drawdown happens every year. And so it's a question of, can we get to a point where the anthropogenic emissions caused by land use and combustion of fossil fuels does not surmount the natural capacity of the Earth to recycle and cycle carbon. And to me, that's doable. And what we know from the book is that we have the know-how and the techniques and practices and technologies to do that in the next 30 years. And all our numbers are conservative. We did not egg the pudding. We did not, you know, blow things up. There's nothing anecdotal in our book at all.
I've heard you say that the biggest criticism you get from folks in the sciences and so on is that you're being too conservative.
Yeah, and which we love.
A badge of honor. Yes.
Yeah, because that was our bias. I should say we didn't have a bias. We did. Our bias was towards the conservative. So that when you look at it, you know, and I can tell you each one of these, it's better than that, it's better than that, and why it's better. But we had to go by peer-reviewed science, and all the economic stuff, numbers, is really based on highly respected international institutions. So the International Energy Agency, the IEA, or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the World Bank, or FAO, and Bloomberg is a very big, rich source of economic information. And so none of the data really in the book, none of it is our data. None of the inputs are our inputs. What we did is put together this information, and what we're reflecting back to the world is what it knows. And every solution we modeled is in place, hands-on, W.W. Granger. We know how to do it, and every one of them is scaling. We didn't model things that, you know, like you said, the silver bullets, this idea that somehow, you know, we can just find this technology that's going to, you know, fix it. We modeled things that we know how to do and are doing very, very well.
And in fact, your coming attraction section is where those things that are out there, as you say, already happening, not fantasy, not sci-fi, but just not enough data, not the peer-reviewed results and so on that you could use to model.
Right.
Of your 100, 20 are coming attractions, and as I understand it, Drawdown Book 2 is probably going to highlight deeper dive into the coming attractions.
Well, we have 1,400 more that we have in our database.
Okay.
And we're going to do about 80. I put that in the book because we modeled what is, but I wanted to show that humanity is on the case, that we are brilliant, ingenious, creative, caring, and look at this one, and look at this one, and look at this one, and who knew, and to give us a sense that it wasn't just a solar panel, you know.
Yeah.
Not to say that solar panels aren't fantastic, but I mean, just like that we're relying on a few technologies, not at all. So I think Coming Attractions gives people a sense that we're together on this, despite what you read every day, and that the momentum is absolutely towards addressing this problem in a way that allows civilization to persist and go forward.
Okay, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work, on Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And for this week's conversation and many others, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to terrencemcnally.net or worldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. I'm speaking with Paul Hawken, entrepreneur and author, about his latest book and the work that went into it and where it goes forward. The book is Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. And you can learn more at Drawdown. That's one word, drawdown.org. And you can learn more about Paul at paulhawken.com.
This is Terrence McNally, and this weekend, when folks around the world took part in a global day of climate action, you're listening to my October 2017 conversation with Paul Hawken about his project and book, Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming.
We've laid a very good foundation of the problem and your approach and even your findings. Talk just a little bit about your method.
Well, we knew that if a small NGO in Sausalito, California prepared a book that said the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, it would have the credibility of a lentil. And just like, thank you for sharing. Furthermore, when we started, we had no money. So that was such a blessing, really, because what happened is that we put the call out to educational institutions all over the world, colleges and universities, for research scientists who would be drawdown fellows. And we got 70 of them from 22 countries and all six continents. And together with our senior fellows, we did the research and the models, created the models. And on top of that, we had 120 advisors, botanists, biologists, engineers, architects, political people, business people, activists, religious people. And then on top of that, we had 40 outside expert reviewers of the models. And we did all that in 3 years. And so it was really a three-step process of creation and review and correction. And so it really is a collaborative. And it was like a small we talking to the bigger we. We're the small we, 230, 40 people. But the big we is all of us. And so we wanted to really emphasize that this is not an individual problem. It's not to say individuals can't do things that are meaningful, no question about it, but the full weight and impact of this should not fall on a person's shoulders, that this is something, you know, that belongs to all of us, that the only way we're going to solve this is by coming together, not by being right or making others wrong. And so we really wanted to emphasize the we-ness of this, you know, as opposed to the me-ness, you know, like I'm right, I know. I would have been wrong on...
Exactly.
I would have been wrong.
And it sounds to me that question that I asked a couple of times is what made you believe that you could take this on at this point? It seems to me that shift that you just talked about was crucial, that when you realized you were going to reach out and ask the questions...
Research. My father taught at the University of California Library. So when I was a kid, I would go to the library every day from school and go to the stacks and sit down and pull books out by the spine and read. And Marion, the librarian, was a hero in our family. So for me, and being a journalist, you know, I love research. I love it. And so I felt I could engender this because I love research. And I'm very curious about the world. And so that's why I knew that nobody had done it. It's never been done, the top 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. It's never been done, you know, which is sort of astonishing when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, better do it as best as we can, and then maybe if someone does it better, well, that's great. But at least you have it out there. You know, you've got the first, you know, first score on the board.
It's interesting. In other words, I think that probably most people, when they see the title and subtitle of this book, Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, probably focus on the word reverse. But I think what's interesting is comprehensive.
Yeah.
Because academia, the corporate world, even the finance world, the government world, people look in their own departments. They look in their own lanes And so in those systems, it's not in their interest to actually be comprehensive. I think it was Bucky Fuller who said there were no departments in nature. And by opening your view wide, you find that's how you found those things which shocked you.
Well, it's actually more humorous than that, the title, because a Stanford intern at Penguin, who published the book, sent the verso, which is what goes on the back of the book, and that was the verso, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. And my editor sent it to me, and I said to him, no, this is not a plan, you know, that's so brash, and, you know, sort of almost arrogant. And but I left that, it kind of intrigued me, and I left it, and I realized that actually, I have to find who this person was. I actually thought it was right. And the reason it's right is that it is the most comprehensive plan because no one's ever proposed.
It's the only.
I could have said the most literate, nuanced, whatever, and still be true because there is no other plan to reverse global warming. And the plan, though, it sounds like, you know, like we have a plan, Dan, you know, kind of thing. We don't. We found a plan. What we're saying is that there's a plan in place already. Because it's scaling and it's happening, and we know how to do it. It's just it didn't come from a white charismatic male vertebrate who is rich and powerful, or you know, it didn't come from singularity, from hierarchy, from somebody who says, you know, I know what you should do. What we're saying is, we seem to know on a collective basis what to do, and not that we can't do it better and more in a more accelerated way if we had support from government and from all institutions. But the fact is, we still know what we're doing, so it is a plan. And that's how the title came about.
Okay, so now let's go to the results. We've teased a couple of times that you'd be surprised. You were surprised.
Very surprised. Very shocked.
So, describe the book a little bit. It is a... it's a magazine size rather than a trade paperback size. It's in paperback. It weighs a ton. When I got it in the mail, I went, wow. But it's the reason I want to do this is because based on our conversation so far, people might think it is a really technical, dry piece of work, and it actually is not. There's 100 solutions. 20 of them, as I said, are coming attractions. 80 of them are already sufficiently out there that there's enough data to rank them. They are ranked by their contribution in reducing CO2. You find out, as I said at the very start, the history of them, how they work, and so on. But each of them gets about a 2-page little section, and you divide it into the larger section. So there's transport, there's food, there's women and family planning. There are sections, and within those sections, you go, okay, here's 10 within this section. Each one of them gets a couple of pages, some wonderful illustrations, and an essay that's actually a very human essay. It has quotes, it has people, it has stories within it that explain how it is, how it works, how it's growing, what contribution it makes, and what it costs. You want to pad that, Annie?
Sure. I have a friend whose son is 8 years old, and that's all he reads. He loves the images. The images are photographs. And then he has his parents tell him, you know, he can read it slowly, but, you know, tell him the story, and then he asks questions. So it's very accessible. At the same time, there's 5,000 references to the work, and they're posted on the website. So it's robust in the sense of what, but yeah, I mean, basically it's a narrative, it's stories, and, you know, stories are what, you know, basically we remember, not facts, and the facts are there too, but almost universally when people see it, they just think, what a beautiful book, and rather than, oh my God, you know, I have to read this, and they don't think that, and that's why I think it became a bestseller the first week and I think it was number 6 this weekend. I mean, still, you know, after 5 months, but on Amazon. But because people buy it to give to others, and it was the first book on climate in over 25 years that became a New York Times bestseller. And the ones before were Al Gore and Bill McKibben in 1989 and 1992. Mm-hmm. So, and I think it did so because it was about possibility instead of probability of what's going to go wrong. And it opened, it makes people hopeful and optimistic. We did not intend to be optimistic. We did not intend to be pessimistic.
Yeah, you didn't start
either.
With an optimistic bias.
No, it's realistic. We tend to be real. This is facts, 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 facts. You know, in God we trust, all others bring data. This is data, but it is with a narrative that is actually, you know, I mean, Catherine Wilkinson and myself wrote the book, and, you know, I didn't just edit it, but wrote it in a way that we try to engage people so that you get interested and fascinated by these different solutions.
And as you said, a gift because it is beautiful and it is a bite size. Right?
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Got 100.
You can open it up and put it down.
You can open it up when you're having you're having lunch. You read you read two solutions. Boom. So there's that to it. It has a momentum to it as well. And then you did sprinkle in a few essays beyond the 100 solutions. Pope Francis, Mark Hertzgard, Michael Pollan, Janine Benyus.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a few added essays. Okay. So the findings. In the top 10, or top 10, top 20, what are the biggest surprises?
I'll tell you a story that in February when we got the numbers, we didn't get the numbers silos. You have to calculate all these things as a system.
Mm, of course.
And so we didn't have the numbers until 2 months and a week before the book was published.
Wow.
And we put the numbers in at the very last moment. And we were all shocked. So shocked so much so that we went back and checked some algorithms and things going, wait a minute. They're still right. And we just didn't see it coming. And during that week, I got a call from a scientist who's one of the most well-known climate scientists and on our advisory board. And they said, you know, how's it going? I said, it's great. We just got the numbers. We're shocked. And I said, I don't think anybody in the world knows the top five solutions to global warming. No one, not Ban Ki-moon or Al Gore or you know, Christiana Figueres or you name them, you know. And I said, we certainly didn't. I'm not trying to point fingers here. I'm just saying we didn't. And this person who is a professor and published and a scientist said, well, what are they? And I said, you tell me. And they did. They said, well, it would be the rapid transit, get rid of cars, no, it'd be EVs. And they kept, you know, kind of going over it, you know, it'd be solar, Okay, here they are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Not in order, but just, you know, in the top five. And they said, how did I do? And I said, that wasn't the point of the question. What was the point of the question, you know? And I said, the point was that you're easily, if you're not the top 100, you're in the top 1,000 of people literate with respect to climate. And for 30 years, you've studied it. And look how long it took you to come up with any five solutions. And I said, if it took you that long, what about the other 99.999% of humanity? And what do they know? And after 40 years of being in the public sphere, we don't even know the top five solutions. And they said, wow, you're right. You know, gosh, I hadn't thought of it that way. And I said, well, how did I do? I said, they're all wrong. and not to make that person wrong at all. This is not a gotcha. It's just like we just didn't know.
And his top five were – none of his top five were in the top five.
None.
Yeah.
Not one. Not even close in some cases.
And my guess, when you go do talks – I guess if you have people raise their hands and so on, this is going to be universal because, as you say, it was the same for you guys. So what is the top five?
The top one is refrigerant management, which is
refrigerant. Let me just say it. You say it quickly. People go, what? Refrigerant management.
I know. Believe me, we were so disappointed when we were like, no.
What kind of a headline is that?
I know. I was like, that's so not sexy.
Yeah. And what does it even mean, refrigerant management?
I mean, I was number one. And HFCs, hydrofluorocarbons, are up to 9,000, almost 10,000 times more powerful than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. And they're released all the time by poorly operated air conditioners, by dismantling of refrigerators and air conditioning, the recycling of them in India and other places like that. And they just go right up into the atmosphere. It used to be Freon, remember?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We banned that because of
Ozone.
Ozone, but this.
The replacements
yeah. are the most, some of the most powerful greenhouse gases ever invented.
Yeah.
And so.
But what you also say is that that one, which can produce the greatest impact per dollar, is that the kind of the way it goes?
No.
Just
the
just
greatest
impact
in terms of gigatons of carbon removed by 2050.
Yeah. Is that it's already happening?
It is. The refrigeration industry is all over this one in developed countries. They're really being super responsible, converting the equipment to the new refrigerants, which are ammonia is one and propane's another, and supercritical CO2 actually is another one.
Why are they already doing it?
Because it's because companies want to do it, and because I don't know. I mean, there's just huge demand for them to do it. They've done 10,000 supermarkets. Our phone jumped off the hook when the book came out. They were so happy about it.
Oh, they're happy because, hey, we're number one, and we're already on the path to doing it.
And we're on the case.
And our investors will now even be more okay with us doing this.
Mostly it's private companies, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's mom-and-pop companies. The industry is really, really balkanized. It's not, you know, I mean, maybe the manufacturers of air conditioners and are certainly centralized, but in terms of maintaining.
Oh, sure, sure. Where the effects actually take place.
Yeah.
Okay, now another one that ranks, as you say, in terms, if you combine a couple, number one would be educating girls and family planning. Spell that one out.
Yeah. Well, educating girls is a pathway to family planning because girls that are yanked out of school before puberty or at puberty for early marriage or to go to work to put their brothers through school end up, you know, when they do marry, which can be right then or subsequently, having on an average of 5 children and, you know, not earning as much because of the lack of education, and their children suffer the consequences in terms of income and schooling and health outcomes. And if they're allowed to matriculate in school through high school, that same girl is becoming a woman more on her terms. She's not becoming an early bride because of culture, religion, or family tradition. And she makes very different choices. She has an average of 2 children, and her children do much better because they imitate their mother in terms of reproduction rates, and they are healthier, they get better schooling, they get more financial support from a woman who's educated. So you have a virtuous circle, you have a vicious cycle, depending on which path you take. So it's one pathway to family planning. The other pathway to family planning is family planning, which is to have clinics everywhere in the world that support women's reproductive health and well-being and family choices. And, you know, people usually think, oh, yeah, Africa. Well, no, I'm talking about Akron and Arkansas and Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere. We mean everywhere. So this isn't like the developing world problem. It's a United States problem. It's a problem in Europe as well. But you put the two together and you use a UN number instead of a high of 10.8 billion people in 2050, you have closer to 9.7. So you have 1.1 billion less people in 2050, and that has a huge impact.
Of course. People plus consumption equals footprint, right?
Exactly.
Let me just say a couple of things about that. One is that Alan Weisman in his book Countdown, where he said, what is the solution to population? And he went all over the world, you know, doing research. He came down again with the same answer. It's the education and the emancipation of women. What's weird is that I have a feeling that that's the answer to almost every question. Right? How do we improve democracy? How do we improve literacy? How do we improve health? One that you don't even include, I'm sure, is when you bring those bunch of minds into the system, educate them and so on, the chances is we got a better chance of coming up with those wonderful technological solutions that people were thinking about before.
Absolutely. I mean, 40% of our rich drawdown fellows are women. It was a meritocracy, so we didn't choose one gender over another. And it just gives you a picture of how quickly women are moving into science all around the world and are achieving, you know, great outcomes. And, you know, it sounds a little reductionist on our part to say, you know, that's like biggest, you know, number, if you combine them together, it's the number one impact on reversing global warming. Because it sounds like, well, that's their importance. And it's not actually their importance. It's all the other benefits that come from basically emancipation of women in the world. And I remember having somebody at a Q&A at a book reading say, you know, okay, but how do we control population? It's such an interesting retrogressive question.
Yes.
And I said, lose the verb. That's the problem. The verb is the problem. It's about empower, not control, you know. And we still have this idea, very male sort of idea, that if we can just control and manage and this and that, you know, and everything, instead of release, open, engender, inspire, you know, and it's just a different way of looking at the world.
Okay, if we are very close to the end. The one thing I want you to do, rather than the big answer of, you know, blah, is just talk for a second about regenerative farming. A minute and a half.
Sure, regenerative agriculture, at its core, is no-till, which you don't break the soil. You don't plow. You don't disc. Because the soil is a living organism, and as soon as you do that, you release carbon. And you, instead of doing that, you use plants to till, quote, the soil, unquote. And cover crops, very complex cover crops, you know, that have amazing results in terms of their root and how they bring in carbon and minerals and change the amount of nitrogen through leguminous fixation. And so that's at the very core of it. And then you get out of the soy corn rotation, which is pretty much the Midwest writ large. And you have complex rotations as well. You don't have to, but you increase the regenerative capacity of agriculture by employing animals. In other words, what you do is you have a cover crop and then somebody eats it. And in a rapid rotational process, you know, there's different names for it, rotational grazing, managed grazing, et cetera. And all these bring carbon into the soil, increase the amount of carbon by a significant amount on an annual basis, making the soils healthier. They retain more water. They're more productive. The plants are more resistant to pests. You know, the animals are healthier. Vet bills go down. Yields go up, costs go down, resiliency to drought and too much rainfall increases. It has so many wins, it's hard to measure.
And it ranks?
Oh, it ranks number 11 and right now, because there really isn't a very good definition of it. We defined it stipulatively. It included some organic practices. Organic farming per se is not regenerative.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on which farm and how they farm. So this is kind of a hybrid solution in the sense of what data we had to use in order to model it. But what you see all over the Midwest right now is you see these no-till society or no-till groups meeting. You see just a huge room full of men with cowboy hats and baseball caps, you know, and cowboy boots sitting down, and because they know that their future depends on restoring the health of the soil, and you can't do it with chemicals.
Okay, let's look at that mess, that image of folks in red states realizing what's good for them turns out is also good for all of us, good for climate change, good for the future. Okay, we got to bring it to a close. There is so much in this book, and I had, you know, another hour's worth of questions, but hopefully we've whet your appetite. Take a look at Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. Buy it, give it at Christmas, give it at graduation. This is a path forward. The websites are paulhawken.com, and that's H-A-W-K-E-N, paulhawken.com, and drawdown.org. The book is Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. Thank you, Paul Hawken. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Terrence. I love what you do.
For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, email me at temcnally@mac.com, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Janine Benyus, Connie Rice, on and on. Thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you.